Okay, I would like to call the Health and Human Service Policy Committee to order. We do not have a quorum, but we're going to start with House File 3028 with Representative Morrison. Representative Morrison, would you like to move your bill and proceed with your presentation? I'm sorry. We won't move it, but we get some. We'll hear about the bill, and we'll lay it on the table until we get a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm presenting House File 3028, which amends sections of individual practice acts for professions regulated by the Board of Medical Practice to remove unnecessary criminal background check fees. Statute authorizes that health-related licensing boards collect a fee associated with criminal background check preparation of fingerprints, criminal record check consent form, and the criminal background check. Fees for criminal background checks are set by the BCA and the FBI. Statute requires all fees collected for the purpose of criminal background check processing be paid to the BCA and the FBI. The boards serve as a pass-through for fees collected and paid to the BCA and FBI and do not retain any portion of those fees collected. Codifying criminal background check fees and individual practice acts for health professions conflicts with the authority established in statute for establishment of criminal background check fees by the BCA and FBI and the collection and payment of fees to the BCA and FBI. And amending this language has no fiscal impact.
All right,
and I do have a testifier.
Yes, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ruth Martinez. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. Representative Morrison, thank you so much for supporting this bill. And I'm here to respond to questions. I think you did a great job of summarizing the issues.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 3028? Mm-hmm. Members, any questions? Representative Albright?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Morrison, all I have to say to you is this is a fine piece of legislation.
Thank you, Representative Albright, Madam Chair.
Okay, so we're going to just hold this one on the table, but I'd like you to stay there to begin to explain your second bill on House File 3043.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3043 makes several technical changes to the Medical Practice Act. It clarifies that a person holding a license, whether active or inactive, due to expiration of non-payment or renewal fees, may be granted cancellation if the licensee is not the subject of a pending complaint investigation or disciplinary proceeding. It prevents a licensee from avoiding a complaint investigation or disciplinary proceeding by allowing the license to expire or cancel for non-renewal. It enables the board to complete a pending complaint investigation or disciplinary proceeding involving a license that is inactive for non-payment of renewal fees. It affirms that such action to grant cancellation must be reported as cancellation in good standing. The bill also states that a license is canceled after 2 years of non-renewal if it is not subject to a pending review, investigation, or disciplinary action. And finally, it clarifies the 7-year statute of limitations for investigating complaints that requires a complaint or report be received by the board within 7 years from the date of commission of some portion of the conduct complained of or reported on.
These are pretty exciting bills. Yeah. I hear the
good stuff.
So, Ms. Martinez, would you like to also speak on the bill?
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Yes, this bill really does a couple of pretty important things, very specifically to the cancellation pieces. This enables the board to complete an investigative or disciplinary process that may be underway and prevents a licensee from being able to cancel a license to avoid some sort of an investigative or disciplinary process. So it's very important for patient safety and public protection. The second change to the statute of limitations, again, really for the purpose of helping complainants understand that 7-year statute of limitations and clarifying that it is on the date that the board receives a complaint that 7-year timeline applies. It was a little bit arbitrary under the current language, and we felt the need to remedy that and make it abundantly clear that when we receive the complaint is when our process begins. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who Who would like to speak to House File 3043? Members, any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morrison, thank you for bringing this bill forward. Once again, it's a fine piece of legislation.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I couldn't agree more. Yes.
So we have a quorum. And so, Representative Morrison, would you like to move House File 3028?
Madam Chair, I move House File 3028 be recommended for placement on the general register.
Okay, great. So, since we have no further discussion, any questions? All in favor of the motion to move House File 3028 to the general register, say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and House File 3028 is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you for that one. So would you also like to now move 3043?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 3043 also be recommended for placement on the general register.
Thank you so much. Is there any more discussion on 3043? Okay, there been no further discussion. Representative Morrison renew her motion that House File 3043 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, so the motion prevails and House File 3043 is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, so we have a quorum, and I know those who've been here have read the minutes. Albright. Representative Albright has...
Madam Chair, I'd move the minutes.
Would like to move the minutes for March the 10th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, the minutes have been moved for March the 10th. Thank you so much. All right, Representative Bonner, House File 3677. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair Morant. And members, I would like to move House File 3677 to be recommended for placement on the general register.
Okay.
I do also have an A1 amendment, okay. Madam Chair, and I'd like to move that amendment as well.
All right. Representative Bonner moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Bonner, please present your bill.
All right. Thank you. Today we have another scintillating bill, but this one in particular relates to occupational therapy. And specifically, these are the folks who every day help folks to carry out the actions of their daily lives. And that could be young toddlers and children who might have some complications. That could be some of our elderly who might have trouble doing daily tasks. And occupational therapists help make sure that not only can they do those things, but they can be independent and live full and rich lives. That said, the bill today is primarily going to be a lot of cleanup and changes to make sure that things make sense grammatically, that they are in the proper order, that terminology matches current standards of practice, et cetera. I will highlight, there are a couple minor things. One is that they will also have some clarification around continuing education credits so that they can make sure occupational therapists continue to do the hard work that they do and get continual education and stay on top of their game. And then there is, I believe, some additional changes on to clarify, that allows for, and allows for us to add some additional methodologies for contact with the board, including put us up into the technological age and adding some really exciting things like email to that list of contacts as well. And with that, I do actually have with me the executive director of the Board of Occupational Therapy here today to speak to you a little bit more in depth. And I, without trying to steal her thunder, I will pass it off to her.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Chris Borland. I am here representing the Minnesota Board for Occupational Therapy Practice. The Minnesota Board of OT Practice was created in 2018. We created an interagency to transition all services from Department of Health to the board, and that happened in mid-April of 2018. Once all of the stakeholders were in place and implementation of the current statute was reviewed, we were able to identify opportunities to really streamline our statute, ensure we're aligned with current national practice standards, improve readability, and clarify language. Everything is pretty much technical or administrative in nature, intended to really modernize language and processes. The OT Member Association is in support of the changes, and there is no opposition that we're aware of. A summary document is in your packets, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take those.
Thank you so much. I really enjoy when we are in the process of updating languages. All right. So thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3677? Okay. Members, any discussion, questions? Representative Edison?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this bill. I just want to thank the testifier and all the occupational therapists. My sons were born, our twins were born prematurely, and we used occupational therapists for years, and with between feeding and just so many other things. So thank you for all the work. And this was the board went through these statutes to help, and you think that this will make it a little easier for you. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Members, any further discussion? All right. Well, there have been no further discussion. Representative Bonner renews her motion that House File 3677, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 3677, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you so much. Okay, Representative Edison, House File 3081, members. Representative Edison.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Move your bill, please, and begin your presentation.
Very good. Madam Chair, the House File 3081 is going to the General Register. Okay, good. So House File 3081 is a culmination of 2 years of comprehensive review of 20 sections of the Board of Social Work Practice Act by stakeholders and staff.
Edison?
Yeah.
Well, one moment. Could you move it?
Oh, sorry. I apologize.
We
yeah.
just need to say the language. We're moving it. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Albright is really trying to help me out here. I move that 3081 be moved to the general register.
Thank you.
Thank you. So it's a culmination of 2 years of a comprehensive review of 20 sections of the Board of Social Work Practice Act by stakeholders and staff. No known opposition exists on this legislation, much like the occupational therapist review we just had. It's an updating of language. The companion bill was passed unanimously in the Senate in HHS Finance and Policy on February 27th. A volume of this bill is based on significant reorganization, not significant change to policy. So there's bipartisan support. It was formally supported by all the different professional organizations, LMFT, I think we've reached out to NAMI, and lots of just other mental health practitioners and people that work in the area. I have with me the board executive director to answer any questions, but it's a housekeeping bill, members, common sense regulatory reform, positive benefits for citizens, workforce, licensees, applicants, social workers, such as myself.
All right, so welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Kate Zacherpate, the Executive Director of the Board of Social Work, and I will just offer a few brief comments. I really do appreciate the support from Representative Edelson and all of the members of the committee. And just to highlight the board's mission, it is protecting the public by ensuring that social workers are qualified, professional, ethical, and accountable. And to that end, we license approximately 16,000 social workers, which reflects 75% of the Minnesota mental health workforce. I will just mention a couple of things about what this bill does not do. This bill does not change the existing social work license types. It does not change scope of practice. It doesn't lower licensing standards. It does not create a licensing compact, and it doesn't change the foundational board governance model or structure. The bill, as Representative Edelson indicated, is supported by stakeholders. You've got 8 letters of support in your packets. No fiscal impact, no opposition. So what does the bill really do? As Representative Edelson said, it creates housekeeping, technical, and policy improvements. It repeals obsolete sections of our Practice Act and obsolete language, does a lot of reorganization, and improves the readability. Specifically, it clarifies current definitions, and it adds new needed definitions. It updates our board member qualifications to increase opportunities to serve, to ensure a more diverse and inclusive board, and to better reflect the demographics of the profession and the citizens of our state. It improves social work license mobility. There is a goal to respond to the mental health workforce shortages by reducing unnecessary licensing barriers for seasoned professionals who are coming to Minnesota to practice, knowing that these professionals are fully vetted and licensed in other states while we're still maintaining standards. It increases the opportunity for semi-retired social workers to continue to contribute to the workforce at a reduced licensing fee by providing licensing supervision, consultation, providing trainings and continuing education. And it clarifies the requirements and reorganizes 7 continuing education sections into 2 for simplification. It increases the opportunity and access for online learning for our licensees. So in conclusion, this bill is common sense regulatory reform. The board believes that this is good government. It reorganizes, modernizes the Practice Act. It creates operational efficiencies and data-driven policy. And the board and staff are really excited to bring these regulatory improvements forward. We're counting on your support and a yes vote on the bill to provide the board and staff the opportunity to continue to move our agency forward to better carry out our mission of protecting Minnesotans in a more efficient and effective manner. Thank you so much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you so much. Is there anyone else, anyone in the audience would like to testify on House File 3081? Okay, members, any discussion? Okay. So let me just say, I just really appreciate Representative Edelson and others who just took the time to work with me to ensure that we was not lowering standards, that the highest standard was still, and there was a lot of technical pieces, because the work the social workers do is highly important to me. And I just wanted to make sure that we were keeping those standards in place. So I really appreciate tracking me down and making sure that I understood that it was keeping those standards, but also just updating a lot of the language and creating pathways. So since there is no further discussion, Representative Edelson renews her motion that House File 3081 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevail and House File 3081 is recommended for placement on the general register.
Thank you so very much.
Representative Morrison. Members, we're on our last bill, House File 3398. So Representative Morrison, I understand that you have 2 authors of amendments. Would you like to move your bill and the amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that House File 3398 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. And I have a delete all amendment and also an A1 amendment to put the bill in the order that I'd like. So I would like to first move the DE3 amendment.
Okay. whom Representative Morrison moves that the E3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? So moved.
And then I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Representative Morrison also moves the A1 amendment, which is a delete all amendment. This is amendment to the delete all amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Amendment so moves. Thank you. All right, could you explain a little bit about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 3398 is a bill aimed at streamlining the prior authorization process. If you have ever been a patient or are related to someone who has been a patient, or if you are a provider, you have likely experienced the frustration of the prior authorization process. Patients across our state are having their care delayed or are paying out of pocket due to waiting for their health insurer to approve payment for a procedure or medication that has been prescribed by their physician and is part of their current covered benefit. This bill updates existing state prior authorization laws to include reasonable criteria to better define the prior authorization process. The updates will help patients by reducing delays in care, will decrease physician frustration, and decrease associated administrative expenses. The DE amendment incorporates many changes that have come from hours of work between proponents and opponents of the bill. There has been movement on the part of the providers and on the part of the payers. Complete agreement has not been reached, but I think a lot of progress has been made. And before I go through the details of the bill, I just want to share a few additional data points. Statewide, hospital prior authorization requests from health plans increased 17% from 2018 to 2019. Small rural hospitals' average increase was 91% in that same time period. FTEs hired to work on prior authorizations increased on average 14% in that year, and small rural hospitals increased in the number of employees doing prior authorizations by 25%. Ambulatory surgical centers saw a 23% increase in prior authorizations from 2018 to 2019. Physicians are spending more time every day on interactions with health plans. Nurses, LPNs, and medical assistants are spending several hours every day interacting with health plans, and practices are spending thousands of dollars per physician every year interacting with the plans, adding healthcare costs to our already overburdened system that do not improve patient care. So in the DE amendment, just to briefly go through some of the highlights, Section 1 is existing language that currently applies only to HMOs. This would apply to all regulated insurers and health plans. It says that a health carrier cannot deny a service solely for the reason of not requesting a prior authorization if they would have approved it if there was a prior authorization submitted. Section 2 adds new language to the jurisdiction section to ensure that entities who provide utilization review for health plans are covered by the law. Sections 3 through 9 update a number of definitions in the chapter where we have referenced existing definitions elsewhere in statute, and I am not aware of opposition to these changes. Section 10 changes the timelines for a standard review determination. Currently, a law allows a utilization review organization 10 business days to approve or deny a prior authorization. The bill reduces this time to 4 business days, so this would be up to 6 days if it occurred over a weekend. This is a major change from the bill as it was originally introduced that reduced all determinations to 36 hours. This is an area where there's been a lot of movement by both sides, and we're close to agreeing, I think. Section 11 changes timelines for an expedited review. Current law allows 72 hours to make a determination, and the amendment reduces that to 48 hours. Section 12 is a technical change that conforms the language to the new definitions. Section 13 changes the timelines for a standard appeals for a denial. Current law allows a URO up to 30 days to decide an appeal. The DE3 amendment reduces this to 15 days. This is another area where there's been major change as the original bill set that time to 72 hours. The other change in the amendment is to reinstate the expedited appeal process that was repealed in the original bill. We keep that timeline at 72 hours. Section 14 makes mostly conforming changes. Subdivision 3 prohibits a URO from retrospectively revoking a prior authorization that was originally approved unless for reasons of fraud or misinformation.
Section 15 requires that the URO's physician who is making a prior authorization decision to have expertise with the case he or she is reviewing. The A1 amendment changes the language on line 9.8 to refer to the same or similar medical specialty as the provider that typically treats or manages the condition. This is another area where we moved closer. The language used to be has experience treating the patient with the illness. Section 16 requires health plans to post on their public website the prior authorization requirements and restrictions, including evidence-based clinical criteria they use. This is to increase transparency to help providers understand the rules and any changes related to prior authorizations. Section 17 requires UROs to disclose any changes to their prior authorization requirements to all in-network providers at least 45 days prior to implementing the changes. This previously was 60 days. Section 18 implements a number of changes to ensure that patients have continuity of care when changing health plans. Subdivision 1 applies to patients who change health plans, that any previous approved prior authorization must be covered by the new health plan for 60 days to allow a transition for the patient to have time to meet with their treating physician to get a new prior authorization. Subdivision 2 prohibits UROs from changing the coverage term for a service that has received a prior authorization during the enrollee's contract year. There is an exemption from this limit for any drug that is deemed unsafe by the DEA or for a drug with a new generic. And Section 19 requires health plans to post on their public website information related to the number of prior authorizations approved and the number that are denied each year. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our testifier, who I'm very grateful came today.
All right. So thank you and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of the proposed changes to prior authorization included in HF 3398. My name is Sheldon Berkowitz, and I'm a pediatrician at Children's Minnesota. I'm also the medical director for case management and utilization management there, and I'm also the president-elect of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. While I understand the desire to lower and control healthcare costs and the role of prior authorization in addressing that goal, I am also very aware of the roadblocks this can present to a clinician wanting to provide the best care for his or her patients and the roadblocks that both patients and families endure while awaiting for the prior authorization to be approved in a timely manner. Thus, I wholeheartedly support the bill's intent to require faster determinations on prior authorization requests. I also believe that the requirement that the person making these prior authorization determinations be a physician and that this person has some expertise treating patients with similar conditions are excellent requirements. One example where this can create delays is in our cardiovascular intensive care unit, where we have often received denials and delays in getting a medication called sildenafil approved for our patients. You may know this generic drug by its more common name, Viagra. And I wouldn't be surprised if many of you may have the same response that some utilization reviewers have, which is, why would a pediatric patient need Viagra? However, in pediatrics, this drug is commonly used to treat pulmonary arterial hypertension, a condition where increased blood pressure due to lung disease can damage the heart. The medication helps to reduce the pressure. Having a URO person not understand this delays treatment and often discharge from the hospital, and having either a pediatric cardiologist, intensivist, or neonatologist reviewing the request or available to answer questions from the requesting clinician would expedite the response and most likely lead to approval. Other examples of common problems we experience with the current prior authorization processes included the following. First, pediatric patients being discharged from the hospital often need to go home on liquid medicines rather than a tablet or capsule. However, some UROs will only approve tablet forms. It is common sense to any of us with children or grandchildren that young children often can't swallow pills. Yet you would be amazed at the number of times we run into this when getting liquid preparations and medications filled. Second, we have experienced denials receiving approval for durable medical equipment, such as feeding pumps, where some utilization review organizations have told us it could take up to a month to get approval. The family can then decide whether to pay out of pocket for the supplies and hope to get reimbursed or keep their child in the hospital until the approval is obtained. Third, URO delays in getting outpatient treatments, such as intravenous immunoglobulin, for immune deficiencies or approval for hemophilia treatment to prevent bleeding problems have often been delayed and resulted in problems that lead to emergency room treatment and or inpatient admissions. Two other examples. First, we have also experienced problems on evenings or weekends or holidays getting prior authorizations approved, leading to delays in discharge. And finally, my favorite are UROs to require a patient to come into the clinic to sign a release of information so that we can appeal a denial on their behalf. Clearly not a good use of the family's time. These are but a few examples of prior authorization problems we encounter every week. Your attempts to streamline and improve the process is a step in the right direction to do the right things for our patients, and I strongly support it. I should also mention a consequence of prior authorization has been that individual clinician offices as well as hospitals have had to hire additional personnel to handle prior authorization issues, and this adds to the overall administrative cost of healthcare without necessarily improving care or keeping overall healthcare costs lower. If you also look at the amount of time the clinicians have to spend trying to get prior authorization requests approved instead of caring for patients, I think we all would agree this is not time well spent. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. So we have a few other testifiers. Sheldon Cosby. Oh, there's a Sheldon. Okay. How about Micah Nerman? Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and good afternoon. My name is Micah Nerman. I'm a pediatrician, and I'm the medical director at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3398. As many of you know, for over 120 years, Gillette has cared for children who have some of the most complex, traumatic, and rare conditions. Many of our patients require lifelong care, but thanks to innovative medical and surgical interventions, along with assistive technology, our patients can reach their fullest potential. I acknowledge the role of prior authorization, but the process needs to be improved. Over the past several years, growing prior authorization requirements have negatively impacted Gillette's patients, families, physicians, and nurses. Since 2017, the number of prior authorization requests that we have submitted has increased by 26%. It is important to note that our denial rate has remained relatively the same despite the increased submissions. At the same time, the number of prior authorization requests that were originally denied but later granted upon appeal, which is typically a very lengthy process, has increased by 33%. This means that our physicians, nurses, and staff are spending an increasing amount of time gathering documentation, writing letters of medical necessity, and making phone calls to justify the care that they know our patients need. In fact, we now employ 10.5 FTEs who work exclusively on submitting, processing, and appealing prior authorization requests. Let me give you a few examples of how the prior authorization process has directly impacted Gillette patients. A child with traumatic brain injury was transferred to Gillette from another hospital's ICU for inpatient rehabilitation. The health plan determined the service was not medically necessary and denied the patient's prior authorization request. The denial letter stated that the care could be provided in an outpatient setting or at home. This child, however, could not be cared for at home. And outpatient care is not an option because there are no skilled nursing facilities for children in Minnesota. We appealed on behalf of the family twice and were denied both times. The child's initial stay in Gillette's inpatient rehabilitation unit was over 40 days. And we exhausted the appeals process and have absorbed the cost of that stay. Another one of our patients had obtained prior authorization for a surgery only to have that decision reversed on the day of surgery while the patient was in pre-op. Although we assured the family that Gillette would work on getting the decision reversed, the sudden reversal created unnecessary anxiety for the family during an already stressful situation. We also care for a child who needed genetic testing to distinguish whether he had cerebral palsy or a rare genetic disorder. The initial prior authorization request was denied, but then was successfully appealed. The process took over 2 months. I would like to share with you his mother's own words about this experience. It's hard enough being a parent of a child who has more advanced medical needs. From rearranging your life and work to get them to their appointments, to also dealing with the emotional toll it can take upon your family, it's a lot. You have to become a part-time medical expert in addition to being a full-time parent and caregiver. The process for obtaining prior authorizations in a timely and transparent manner certainly can and should be improved. For the many steps that this bill will take to improve and reform the prior authorization process, I ask for your support. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any of the committee's questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the information. Appreciate it. We're going to go on to Catherine Commit.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Madam Chair, I neglected to thank my bipartisan authors in both the House and the Senate. And also I wanted to thank MMA and the hospitals for their help and the good faith negotiations that we had with the plans. I think that we had a productive process, and I think we're going to be close to agreeing on a good end result.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Dr. Morrison. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is the trade association for Minnesota's 7 nonprofit health plans. I want to start by saying we hear the concerns about prior authorization. We share the goal of patient-centered care, reducing unnecessary administrative processes, increasing patient satisfaction, and improving quality and outcomes, as well as affordability. Prior authorization is used because care delivered doesn't always follow the latest medical evidence or best practices. And there can be wide variations in the treatments given to patients by clinicians for the same medical condition. Health plans are uniquely situated with the healthcare system to help curb overutilization and unnecessary services, the cost of which has an enormous impact on the healthcare system. Studies have shown that unnecessary spending makes up over 30% of the total spending on the healthcare system. Further, unnecessary services can cause more harm than good for patients due to side effects or possible complications. Prior authorization turnaround times that are arbitrarily rushed could lead to more prior authorizations being denied because there isn't enough time to gather the necessary information to make a determination. Since the bill's introduction a few weeks ago, we have been working closely with the bill's proponents to find a workable compromise that maintains an appropriate prior authorization system while improving the process. Both sides have been negotiating in good faith. More work remains, and we are committed to continuing to work towards a viable compromise. I do want to point out that today, health plans still receive a sizable number of prior authorization requests that are submitted through a fax machine. Since 2016, providers have been required under Minnesota statute 62J.497 to submit drug prior authorization requests electronically. However, in surveying my members, the health plans report that about one-third to two-thirds of all the prior authorization requests are still submitted through a fax machine, which is not an electronic, which is not considered an electronic submission under the law. As a result, the prior authorization process can be much slower than it is supposed to be. Health plans cannot improve the turnaround time without the cooperation and partnership of the provider community. That state law went into effect in 2016. It is now the year 2020. If more providers could submit requests electronically, it would go a long way to reduce those turnaround times. I also want to point out one complicating factor that just we just learned about on Monday, which are new federal rules issued by CMS on IT interoperability. These rules are effective on January 1st of 2021, and they number 1,600 pages of rules. The new federal rules are going to be a big challenge for the health plans as well as providers, especially smaller providers, to upgrade their systems by the end of this calendar year. These new federal rules are going to affect our ability to meet the requirements of this bill. Assuming this bill is enacted, we will work to implement this legislation by the deadline. But I want everyone to understand the breadth and scope of these new federal rules. In the long run, these changes will benefit consumers first and foremost. But there will be a tremendous amount of time, money, and resources that will have to be devoted to meeting the requirements of these rules. In summary, we too want the healthcare system to work better and faster and be more efficient for patients. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right, thank you so much. Bentley Graves. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I think most of you know, but the Minnesota Chamber is the state's largest business trade association. We have 6,300, we represent 6,300 members around the state, all sizes of business, all areas of the state. And they employ roughly 500,000 employees around the state. And we work on healthcare issues because it's a significant concern for our members of all sizes around the state. You've heard from Representative Morrison and the proponents and even Ms. Commit about the concerns and problems that have come to the fore with the use of prior authorization. We continue to think that prior authorization is an important tool to ensure effective, safe, and affordable care for Minnesotans, for patients. But we've engaged in the conversation around this bill because we want to make sure, you know, if given the opportunity, that this process can be improved, that there can be more transparency, that it can work better for patients, and yet still maintain its effectiveness as a tool to ensure, again, safe and effective and affordable care. The DE3 that was brought forward today, I want to thank Representative Morrison and the folks that have been working on this, addresses a number of the concerns that we had with the original bill. And I won't go through all those today, but we very much appreciate, as was alluded to before, you know, much of the good faith effort that's been happening on the different sides of this issue to find a way forward to the bill, and we certainly want to be a part of that conversation going forward as well. Given that, there are still a few questions we have with the language in the DE. We have some question about some of the language in the jurisdiction section under Section 2 about whether or not and how far that might reach up into self-insured plans, ERISA plans. We also, as was mentioned by Representative Morrison and Ms. Commit, want to make sure that agreement can be found on the timelines, on bringing the timelines down. Our concern, though, is just that if those are brought down too far and too fast, that it would result in more denials, and or, you know, a turning away from the use of prior offense, those situations where it's warranted. So Representative Morrison said that that's an area that has been under significant discussion, and there's been significant movement on both sides. And I'm not sitting here in a position to tell anybody what those timelines should be. Our interest is making sure that whatever can be found in agreement in that area of the bill is something that actually works for patients, yet still kind of maintains the usefulness of the tool. And then finally, in the section of the bill, section 18 under continuity of care, the DE3 does remove a portion of that original section that was of significant concern to us. But the language that remains, we'd just like to be part of the ongoing conversation around making sure that language works, that process works. This is an idea or proposal in different forms and fashions over the past several years that when applied to public programs has raised some concerns and unintended consequences about access to care and costs. And so we just want to make sure that the language is there, the process that is there, works and works well, again, for patients and can move forward. Having said that, I will note, you know, one thing that one change that the DE3 does make is it does take out, as far as I know, Minnesota Care and medical assistance, and you know, that's always a concern to us when proposals come forward to make changes to the benefits that our members offer to their employees but don't otherwise apply to the public programs that the state pays for. You know, I think there's reasons for doing that, and I understand that, but it's nevertheless something I wanted to flag and just note for folks. But having said all of that, again, we really appreciate the amount of work that's been done thus far. I want to continue to work on this going forward so we can find a bill that is agreeable to folks involved in this process from both sides and that works for patients, but still maintains the usefulness of the tool for safety, effectiveness, and cost. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3398? Okay, Representative Edison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if Ms. Commit could come back down.
Thank you, Ms. Kmit. You had mentioned that care delivered doesn't match the best practices in terms in your statement. And I heard the doctor, Dr. Nierman from Gillette, say that there was a patient that had their surgery approved and then that approval was removed. That doesn't match best practices in my mind. As somebody that has had children that have gone through numerous surgeries, it's incredibly frustrating to hear that that's happening to families. So I hope that you can make sure that your the health plans in your partnership know that that's not okay. I don't know if it, I imagine it was probably somebody within it, but you think about what that looks like for a family. We create these policies. We don't know what it actually looks like for the family that day. I'm sure they had to take off work. They had to schedule it for weeks ahead of time. And that person's story is probably one of many. I'm a breast cancer survivor. I remember I changed health plans right here with our own state insurance. And I take tamoxifen as a part of my treatment. And it didn't transfer over. And apparently I had to go get another prescription and get a pre-authorization for that, which made no sense to me because I'd already been taking it for 2 years. So I think that we have to be very careful about the things that we say in terms of best practices, because medicine does define best practice. And I think that we need to follow and listen to our doctors. So I hope, I truly hope that you're working with Representative Morrison on what she's doing here.
Mrs. Clement, would you like to respond?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Adelson, thank you for your comments. When I heard the testimony earlier, that doesn't sound right to me either. That's not acceptable. I don't know the details of that particular situation. I don't know if it was one of my health plans or perhaps another health plan. I don't know if it was a fully insured product or if it was something that is through a self-insured plan where the employer may be making certain decisions about what they want to have covered or not. But you're right, that is not acceptable, absolutely. And I would also say that we are working very closely. We've had a very good working relationship with Representative Morrison, and we've had very cordial discussions with the proponents. This is something that has been worked on for a number of years, and I would say that this is the farthest that we have come in working out the issues related to this, related to the issue of prior authorization. It is true that that there are occasions when there are some physicians who order things that aren't necessary or may even be harmful. The health plans sometimes have a line of sight into a particular patient's medical history that the physician may not have, not always, but sometimes. And sometimes those prior authorizations can make a difference in helping to avoid a certain type of outcome that isn't desired. The information that I'm referencing from a journal article, a medical journal article, talks about over-treatment in the United States. So they're looking at all 50 states. Do we do it better here in Minnesota? I'd like to think so. I'd like to think because we are represented by 7 nonprofit health plans that we are local, we are here to work with people, here to work with the providers, and try to do what's best for the patient. The patients are also concerned about cost, so we have to take that into consideration as well. But you're right. If when patients need care and it's medically necessary, they should be able to rely on that, on getting the care that they need.
Representative Edison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I hope that you'll speak with the doctor and find out what plan that was and see if they're a member of your partnership. And then Representative Morrison, if I could just ask you one other thing on page 12 of your bill.
Could you just stay there for a moment?
Line 12.28, you talk about the annual posting on the website of the prior authorizations for which plans are approving and not approving the prior authorizations. It says it's going to be on the plans, the health plans company public website. And I'm wondering if you've, Representative Morrison, thought about having that reported to the state so that, I mean, I think that would be, I think it's very helpful data to have. Is it possible, I mean, will consumers be able to see that and find it? Or is it something that we should have like within, you know, on the Department of Commerce's website or something like that? So I just would think about that.
Representative Dr. Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Edelson, the intent is for it to be public, but I'll take that under consideration. That's an interesting point. Thank you.
I have a question for you, Ms. Commit, just so I can be a little bit more informed about the Minnesota Councils of Health Plans. Could you share with us the makeup of those who are, is it a board? Who's making those decision-making process? And give me some back information of who they are and the expertise that they bring to the council, to the health plans.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. The Minnesota Council of Health Plans is a trade group that represents seven nonprofit health plans. Those plans here in Minnesota are Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Hennepin Health, Health Partners, Medica, Preferred One, Sanford Health Plan, and UCare. Each of the plans have a board. They're all nonprofit organizations. They all have boards made up of people from the community, including medical experts and others who are devoted to achieving the community mission of that particular health plan. All the health plans are organized to help patients and enrollees access health care through various health insurance products. And each of the health plans has a medical team, including a medical director who is an MD, who also helps oversee the medical policy in each health plan.
Thank you, Ms. Commit. And part of their work is to be well informed and educated on best practices in the latest evidence of what that looks like in the medical profession. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. You know, frankly, practicing physicians are often very busy. They are seeing a lot of patients, and it's a very big job to try to keep up on the very latest medical evidence and that sort of thing. It's not to say that they don't, but it's a very big job. And sometimes there are other organizations that can keep track of some of those things, and the health plans may tap into some of that information to be able to keep their medical practices and medical policies up to date on what is the most beneficial for enrollees and patients.
Thank you. And Ms. Commit, is it fair to say that the nonprofits and the health plans, their best interest is in maybe their profits in versus the patients, or?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, because they are nonprofit organizations, mm-hmm. they're not focused on meeting the latest quarterly results in order to please stockholders or Wall Street, for that matter, but instead are working to make sure that they are providing the very best products for their enrollees and that enrollees are getting the care that they need at an affordable price. So I'll just leave it there.
So they don't make profits?
Well, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. they every year the health plans report what their past year financial experience was, and it is true. Some years they have an operating margin, and some years there is not an operating margin. But it varies year to year, depending on the experience of the losses and claims that transpired in that past year. So it will vary, but I can tell you that the health plans are heavily regulated by both the Departments of Health and Commerce, and every year the health plans have to bring forward new product filings and to the departments to say, here's what we're going to be offering for the next year, and here's how much we think it's going to cost based on actuarial analysis. The departments then take a look at that information and decide whether they think that's the right amount of premium to charge, or if it's too little. Sometimes they say you're not going to be collecting enough based on how we review your actuarial analysis. Or they may come back and say, that's too much. You have to sharpen your pencil and bring those numbers down. That all takes place during the spring, summer, and into the fall. And at the end, in the fall is when those products are finally are finalized and then brought to market so that the public, employers, individuals, and others can shop for coverage for the next year.
A couple of more questions, Mrs. Commit. So you mentioned in 2016, the law changed that all prescriptions or requests needs to be made electronically, and a fax is not electronically, it's not electronic. So specifically, how should it be submitted, and what do providers need to do, or what do we need to do as legislators to make sure that we are being as efficient and effective and timely as necessary?
Madam Chair, thanks for the question. Well, it requires probably for providers to become, to have an electronic medical record. So that means not having paper records anymore. Most providers are moving in that direction or have moved in that direction, but there still are some providers who, for whatever reason, still maintain paper records. And even when there are providers who do have an electronic medical record, they need to be sure that they have the latest software that will allow them or facilitate the process of being able to submit an electronic prior authorization so that that can happen instantaneously and send it to the health plan. And the health plan is also required to receive those electronic submissions and respond electronically as well. When it comes in the form of a fax, the plans will deal with it, but it just slows that process down. And, you know, it's not the most secure process to have a bunch of papers that you could drop a paper or miss something. So it's preferable, much more preferable, to use an electronic system.
All right. Thank you for that. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm working through the bill, I apologize that I'm not finding the sections here, but I just want to clarify, Representative Morrison, does this bill expand what plans would be required to cover, or does it simply affect the prior authorization process?
Representative Morrison, Dr. Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative New, it does not expand.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Morrison, and perhaps this question is more appropriate for Ms. Commit, but do you know what is the current process for gathering the information necessary to make a determination? Is that clear to providers right now?
Representative Morrison?
Madam Chair, Representative New, the process for requesting is clear. I think it can be somewhat opaque how the decision is made for providers.
Okay.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps that question would be more appropriate for Ms. Commit. I know she mentioned the process for gathering information that's necessary for making the determination, that can take some time. And so I'm wondering right now what that process looks like.
Ms. Commit.
So, Madam Chair and Representative New, I'm sorry I didn't hear your whole question, but are you asking about what is the process that happens when a provider is submitting the request for prior authorization, or... I'm sorry, can you clarify?
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you had mentioned that that part of the difficulty here is in gathering the necessary information to make a determination. And so I'm wondering, what does that process look like right now? Is it simply a form that the provider fills out? And as you indicated, sometimes that's faxed in. It should be electronically submitted. But how is that information gathered? If you need additional information, how do you go about accessing that? And are the providers currently aware of the information that they need to submit in order to get that authorization?
Ms. Commit.
And Madam Chair and Representative New, I am not an expert in this area, so I will have to go back and get definitive information for you. But my understanding is that that when completing an electronic prior authorization, it does have, the plan has a form and has these fillable fields that need to be completed so that when that's submitted, then that information then can be put into a queue and handled right away. Typically what happens, so if it's a more complicated situation or somebody has a a particularly rare condition, that's when sometimes there needs to be some cross-communication between the provider and the health plan to better understand the nature of that, or if there's a particular drug that's being requested that isn't usually recommended, that sort of thing. So yes, sometimes there is some information gathering that takes place on both sides to be able to understand exactly what is happening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My last question is for Representative Morrison. I do, and I'm generally supportive of the bill, but I do get concerned when we are exempting state programs. Why are medical assistants in Minnesota Care being exempted from this?
That's a good question. Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative New, thank you for the question. We made the determination in a non-budget year that we didn't want to have fiscal impact. So the plan is to come back and include public programs next year.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So the good news is that a lot of my questions, I think, got asked by the chair and by Representative New. So I'll try to keep it a little bit more tight. But I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Morrison for this work. This is a really incredible bill. And I can tell you, as someone who actually worked in a former life, as someone who did prior authorization, this is the culmination of what I hoped would have been there. And I won't say how many years ago, but many, many years ago. This has been an ongoing problem. And I do know that the folks who work in this field are very good about helping physicians and patients navigate those waters and figure out what, in fact, they do need to submit. But I can tell you that often that process was extremely frustrating, and it could take days, it could take weeks, it could sometimes take months to do that. And I remember often working with specific patients and giving them my direct dial number to work with them, because they had been passed from agent to agent to agent and had to repeat their story again and again and again, slowing down the process and adding to that administrative piece, which, of course, as we do that, also means that we're adding cost. And when we talk about making sure that the whole point of this process is to save cost, I would argue that some of that inefficiency is actually driving up cost, and can be really problematic. So we need to make sure we do strike a balance, particularly when you consider the high percentage of these cases that will, in the end, actually be approved versus what is not. In other words, most physicians are very good about knowing what the rules are and what they can and can't do to provide the best treatment for their patients. And they are actively doing that. And in some cases, this process can significantly get in between that relationship between a physician and the patient. So I really appreciate this. And I would also push back on one point that one testifier made about line of sight. I'm going to push back on that hard, because I'm going to be upfront with you. More often than not, in actually doing this work, what I find is that the physician has a much better line of sight in terms of what the patient's needs are, and what they're on, what things they've tried and failed, all of these pieces, far more so than anyone on the other end of a prior authorization hotline. So I just want to be clear about that. And the last thing I'll say on this is, I can tell you that this has also been an incredible frustration in that in my own family, my sister was prescribed an insulin pump because of various challenges with her heart and other areas of her diabetic care. She's been diabetic since age 3. She was prescribed a pump because the physician felt very strongly that this was the best way to manage her disease and get it under the best control and keep her at her as healthy as possible. And with an 8-year-old at home, that's extremely important, right? She wants to be there for him. But about 2 months in to using that pump, she received a letter saying that they had turned down her authorization for that pump that she was already in use and had to switch to a less optimal method that did not actually provide the best treatment options for her or her disease. And let's be perfectly clear, by doing that, that also means that she's at a substantial risk of creating other adverse side effects and driving up cost once again because she's not getting the best treatment. So I want to thank you for this bill. Thank you for doing this hard work. Thank you to the plans for being willing to sit down and negotiate. I really do appreciate that. This is far overdue. Thank you, Representative Morrison.
Thank you. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we like to pretend that medicine is a one-size-fits-all entity, right? And that's how we're going to save money. We treat everybody the same. And that is completely erroneous, right? We have two patients. Both have migraine headaches. The causes of their migraine headaches are completely different. And I know that because I talk to those patients, right? We have conversations and we have a relationship. And so I recommend two different medications to treat the same thing, but they get denied because there's only one medication on the list. Now, my patients don't get the treatment that they need because, again, we pretend that everyone, to save money, should get the same treatment. And to say that someone who has never spoken to my patient, has never laid eyes on my patient, to say that they have a better line of sight into their treatment and their condition is absurd. Absurd. So, Madam Chair, I have a question for Ms. Commit. Oh, I can't think straight. thank you. Ms. Commit. You said the purpose, one of the purposes of the organization was to decrease administrative burden. That's a quote. So with all the testimony that you've heard today, increase in FTEs, increase in time per person spent on prior authorizations, and the increased cost to this, wouldn't you agree that prior authorizations have the exact opposite effect of decreasing administrative burden?
Ms. Commit.
Madam Chair and Representative Mann, I admit that there is some cost to doing prior authorization, no doubt about it. We have to employ people who will be on the health plan side for that prior authorization. From the testimony we heard today, providers also have to have somebody staffing to address those things. So yes, there is some additional cost. But I think that the view is that it still is a valuable tool to help reduce certain healthcare costs and try to find the very best treatments for patients in certain cases.
Ms. Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, you also said that part of the goal is to increase patient satisfaction. And I got to tell you, in 13 years that I've practiced medicine, I've never, not once, heard a patient say, thank goodness for that prior authorization. that 30-day that I didn't get my treatment really made me think about my choices. So wouldn't you agree that prior authorizations go directly against patient satisfaction?
Ms. Commit?
Madam Chair and Representative Mann, based on that example that you just gave, yeah, that would be frustrating. But I can also tell you there are cases when a physician prescribes something and finds out, oh, that particular medication is going to be require a prior authorization because it's got a very expensive cost or it has these particular potential side effects. And if they are doing it electronically or looking at everything that might be available to that particular patient, they might actually select a different medication that still has a good outcome for the patient without causing additional costs for the patient in the form of higher premiums or higher copays and that sort of thing. But we don't hear back from the patient saying, hey, thanks for doing that. So it probably happens both ways.
Representative Mann.
Last question, Madam Chair. Don't you think that 30 days to get your treatment is too long?
Ms. Commit.
Madam Chair and Representative Mann. So the language that's in the bill was enacted, I think, in like 1998. And so it's true that these this section of statute really hasn't been updated. And so one of the things that we are working on in with Representative Morrison and with the proponents of the legislation is to reduce those turnaround times, and we've made a lot of progress already to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Albright.
We're close, aren't we? I've been working on this for 4 years. Representative Morrison, thank you for being the champion this biennium on this legislation. I started this program back in 2016, and then Representative Hamilton brought it forward in 2018. So you're the new rookie, but no longer. Madam Chair, I wonder if Dr. Nierman would answer a couple questions for me.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Nierman, in your testimony, you mentioned a couple of interesting statistics. One, that your PA submissions have increased 26%, but also the number of denials on those PAs has increased by 30%. Am I correct in that hearing?
Sure. Dr. Nierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for the question. So you're correct. So the denial rate itself overall has remained relatively the same, but the number of services that we put through for the prior authorization process has increased 26%, but then there's been a significant increase. Then they're initially then denied, we go through an appeal process, and then we get a final approval. And so that's where we're feeling a real pinch as well, is having to go through that appeal process.
Representative Albright.
Dr. Nierman, so let me play that out. So eventually they get approved. So is it based upon a lack of information that you are electronically providing to the HMO, or is it a function of not understanding the data? Help me to kind of elaborate in terms of what initially is purposed in the denial itself.
Dr. Nierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. So that's an excellent question. There are a number of reasons why there are appeals processes that are put in place. You're correct. So there has been a more demand on documentation justification for whatever that service may be. So for example, any of these services could cover, for example, surgeries, or they could cover durable medical equipment, MRIs, for example. Take MRIs, for example. Many of our patients have chronic conditions and needs, and they are have disabilities which require sedated MRIs, which most patients often do not. So oftentimes we will have, we will put through the process for, say, an MRI of a spine, which requires sedation. That will get denied. We'll go back and provide more information to explain the fact that this is a patient who can't remain still in an MRI scanner, which takes several hours, oftentimes, depending on the scan, in order for it to be completed correctly. So that's one case, or even just with MRIs, just having then a reviewer look at it and say they actually think the MRI would be better without contrast versus with. And so there are so many of these different CPT codes that go along with these MRIs that then we have to go back and then justify to that particular CPT code why that imaging is necessary. So that's one example of why that appeals process becomes incredibly cumbersome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Nierman, the patient probably doesn't care what CPT code you're going to enter. That's rhetorical.
Sure.
But I understand that they're working with a number of procedures. So my question next is, when you submit that PA, are you dealing with a peer that would understand that? Are you getting someone out of a calling pool that just takes the call when it comes in based upon submission, or are you availed to someone that would understand the severity and the sophistication of the case based upon your entity and based upon the work that you do on behalf of your patient load? It would seem to me like you would have a dedicated group of people that would first and foremost understand what it is that you do and have the wherewithal to respond in a more timely fashion. I'm leading you to a question in terms of, do you get that kind of service, or is it someone that is not understanding of the circumstances and they have to go and find a peer that would understand circumstances?
Dr. Newman.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you very much for that question. So You are exactly right. It has been very difficult for us, and Dr. Berkowitz also discussed this in his testimony as well, to have these cases reviewed by providers who are well-versed in the medical issues that are at hand. For example, in the case that I provided regarding the patient who had traumatic brain injury and was transferred to our rehab center, they were unaware that in the state of Minnesota there are no skilled nursing facilities for children. This is an adult, that's an adult service. But that was what they had recommended, and they were steadfast on. So it is, it's incredibly important to have that type of experience and expertise with the health plans as they're reviewing these cases, to have that level of insight. So that would be terrific.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For either Dr. Nierman or Dr. Berkowitz, but from a best practices standard, most of the clinical work that is done in the state of Minnesota now subscribes to some type of an electronic medical record, whether that be Epic system or some other electronic medical record system. You are being provided with, my assumption, some type of a formatted questionnaire from the HMOs directly onto that, that would then transfer the data directly that they're requesting for purposes of verification of that PA. Would that be correct?
Dr. Nierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. Yeah, thank you very much. You know, in fact, we are working, for example, the ideal, we have Cerner, and Dr. Berkowitz working with Children's has the same computer system. We're working currently to have that upgraded so that we could do, say, for example, authorizations, prior authorizations electronically for medications. But this, it can be somewhat difficult just given, well, I would just say yes, it would be ideal to be able to do this all electronically.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Dr. Nierman, this is not to be trite, but how long has it been since you've had a fax machine in your hospital?
Dr. Nierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, you're talking to someone who recently just got rid of his pager. So,
Madam Chair, I'd like to call my next testifier. Right. I would, actually.
Well,
yes.
Yesterday.
Ms., if I could recall Ms. Commit down to the testifier.
Ms. Commit, please. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Commit, I'm looking at Section 10 of the bill as it's been amended under the standard review determination. And even with the continued use of a fax machine, what would be the harm in moving from 10 business days to 4 business days, particularly if the medical community is moving towards a best practices standard of using electronic medical records?
Please commit.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. We're in negotiation about this this number. We had suggested we would move from 10 days to something to 7 days if providers did not use the electronic prior auth, but move to 5 days if they did use the electronic prior auth. We want to do what we can to incentivize providers to move to that system so that it's everybody's following the requirements in law. So this is still something that we're discussing.
We're close. Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. Similarly, Ms. Commit, on Section 11, and I'm going to use a personal example. So the difference between 72 and 48 hours is 1 day. But in the context of a broken patella, and the difference between a diagnosis of a broken patella and maybe a torn ACL, particularly with regard to an X-ray, won't identify the ACL tear, but an MRI would. In the context of the timeliness of fixing and going through the surgery, it is of the essence. And so help me understand if what expedited means to avoid an adverse outcome for that patient. I understand we might be close, but can we agree that 48 hours, even if it's over the weekend, could mean the difference between a good outcome and a bad outcome for a patient?
Representative, let me just say that we are supposed to end at 4 o'clock. I have Representative Robinson who would like to speak, and I have a question. So,
I could wrap up in four notes.
Four notes?
Four notes.
Okay. Yes, please respond.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, yes, of course, if somebody's suffering like that, of course they're going to want some resolution to that right away. Part of the challenge is it depends on what the person's health insurance coverage is. Again, it's hard to know what kind of a product they have. That's part of our system that we have in the United States, is people have different types of coverage depending on whether they get an individual plan or through their employer and that sort of thing. 48 hours could happen. I mean, we could get the request at 10 to 5 on a Friday and then be required to respond by 10 to 5 on Sunday. And oftentimes people aren't working over the weekend. Providers aren't maybe not working over the weekend, or we aren't able to reach those people. So having 72 hours does help. Certainly we will try to turn that around much faster than that.
Madam Chair, and I guess commit to that. Injuries don't clock out at 5, and that's not to be trite. But neither to providers that are in the hospital waiting for authorization to take care of their patients. They don't close their business on 5 o'clock on Friday and come back to take care of their patients on Monday. And so I would really urge you to reconsider the position that the health insurance companies have taken on that, because good outcomes are not going to wait until Monday morning for anyone. I do have a question with regard to the compliance with prior authorization approval. It seems odd that a conformity to pre-existing prior authorization wouldn't be honored, and I'm just wondering why you would not honor that. Is it because you're accepting a new plan or a new a group under this? At the very least, wouldn't you want to identify to those people that are under a prior authorization protocol that it's under review? I don't see that in there, but I think that might be beneficial to at least notify the people that there may be a circumstance where they would have further questions. I don't see that in here. I think it's just a part of a 60-day review between insurance companies, but I would urge you to take a look at that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Robbins, is your question to Ms. Commit?
Yes, just in terms of the explanation, in terms of why they would want to review the prior authorization from another company and not honor it. Okay. And that might be my last question.
That's the question.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, we are looking at that section. We're in discussion with the proponents on that section, so we are still looking at that.
Representative Robbins, because I want Ms. Commit to stay there, but go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief. Dr. Nierman, would you mind coming back? Thank you. Thank you. There was a lot of discussion about the increase recently in the number of prior auths, and I wondered, why is that? This process has been around for a while. Did something change? Why is there a dramatic increase recently?
Dr. Nierman.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question. I think it would would be best suited for the insurance plans to ask why that's the case. There hasn't been a change in our practice that would reflect a need for that increased scrutinization. And I think that the data that I provided demonstrates that through our appeals process, our denial rate is still relatively the same. So the care we're providing is no different than what we, and it's still excellent care. So I guess if you don't mind, I would like to defer to my.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. And I believe the chair wants Ms. Kmita anyway to return. So okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kmita, can you respond to Representative Robbins' question?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. I don't know the answer to that, so I'm going to talk with the physician and ask him about what has been the experience at his organization to find out why that increase has occurred. It probably has something to do with who the ultimate payer is of that particular, of those patients, which can vary. It may be Medicaid, it may be a private insurance plan, it might be a self-funded plan, but those, all those factors will affect how that, the prior authorization process happens. So I'll follow up with him and then we'll follow up with you.
Representative Robin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that gets to my next question. So I share Representative New's concern that we are carving out the state programs. And I understand, you know, you just want to get this done, which I respect. It's hard to get things done. But nevertheless, I think there has to be some way to try and track any cost increase from this or any cost savings from this. And then if we do go back and apply this to public programs, perhaps it should be some of the reporting requirements. If they're going to list the number of denials and referrals or whatever, maybe somehow we need to track, is this helping or is this hurting? Because there will be a cost. Clearly, if you don't want the fiscal note, there is going to be a cost. And I think we're all very much interested in at least knowing what those costs are, and maybe it's worth the cost, but I think we need to somehow track that. And I don't know if that's possible to track all these different plans and all these different individual things, but I'd encourage the working group to consider that. Thank you.
Thank you. And really quick, Ms. Kmita, when was the Minnesota Council of Health Plan created? Because I'm sure they have not always been around.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they were, they were formed in
1985. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know why they was created or formed, but you mentioned that they're there for some oversight and evidence of physician errors and things like that. So I would like to request just some more information. I don't know if you do any data collections, you know, as to the amount of errors we're seeing now or the benefits of having the Minnesota Council of Health Plans still with this oversight and the delay of, you know, prescriptions and things like that. And if you can just maybe submit that to me and maybe the committee here around, you know, where we are now and how you are saving even providers or patients or feel that, you know, the council is needed for this oversight of physicians or not. Just you could just share some of where we are right now currently. That'd be helpful. Because I just cannot wrap my mind around if I went to the doctor and needed a prescription, I had to wait 30 days for authorization. I don't, you know, I can't even imagine what that looks like or why it would be needed or necessary. If I've been cared for by a physician with my time and, you know, and I believe them and trust them, you know, why can they not do what I feel that they need to do based on the interests of a patient? So it's hard for me to just wrap my head around this whole 30 days delay. So with that, and since we have no further discussion, I would like to renew Representative Morrison's motion that House File 3398 as amended be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 3398 as amended is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. Members, I would like to just thank say you, before we leave that we are meeting on Friday. We're meeting on Friday at 9 a.m. in room 200 here in the State Office Building, right here. So I see you guys Friday at 9 o'clock. Thank you. We are adjourned.